While they were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Keeping good company. There was quite the interesting report on NPR a couple of weeks ago. The story was about an artistic rendering of Jesus created by a Canadian sculptor, Timothy Schmalz. It is a life-size bronze statue which depicts Jesus as a homeless vagrant. Jesus is curled up, seemingly asleep on a park bench, with a blanket covering his head and hands. The only clues that reveal Jesus's identity are the wounds on his feet, the unmistakable marks of state-sanctioned murder at the hands of the Roman Empire. The statue was purchased by a liberal and inclusive Episcopal congregation in an affluent neighborhood in Davidson, North Carolina. According to the church's rector, Reverend David Buck, the $22,000 sculptor should serve the community as a reminder that faith ought to express itself in active concern for the marginalized of our society. But yet, once placed outside the church, for some in the community, elitist cultural practices outweighed their so-called progressive and inclusive theological commitments. Some felt depicting Jesus in this manner was disrespectful to the Son of God. One neighbor wrote the local paper and to say that the image creeps him out and thus ought to be removed. And then there was the neighbor who mistook the statue for a real person and thus called the police. You heard me correctly. A woman called the cops on Jesus for being outside of a church. To this woman's credit, though, I guess, she did not change her position when she discovered that it was a depiction of Christ. For she told a reporter from the Washington Times, "That's not who Jesus is. Jesus is not a vagrant. Jesus is not a helpless person who needs our help. We need someone who is capable of meeting our needs, not someone who is needy." End quote. This story is interesting to me in relation to the appointed lectionary text for this third Sunday in Easter. For today's text provides us a narrative of Jesus' appearance following his resurrection. Two disciples, one named Cleopas, they're walking on a road toward Emmaus. Emmaus is a city maybe between 7 to 10 miles from the capital city of Jerusalem. And the disciples are on the road to Emmaus, in effect fleeing Jerusalem, the place where they had just witnessed the crucifixion of their spiritual leader and teacher. Suddenly, Christ appears, but due to the mood of the two disciples, they do not recognize him. What's their mood? Well, it's safe to say, my dear friends, that they are both angry and anxious. They're angry that Jesus was executed for the crime of sedition and deemed an enemy of the state for opposing a world order defined by imperial power and persecution of the less powerful. And they were anxious. They were anxious to know whether they would be delivered from their oppressors or had their zeal for justice been little more than a fool's errand. A waste of their energy. They're angry and they're anxious. But the disciples are also, they're also afraid and flummoxed. They're afraid that they too might get crucified for being a part of this radical Jewish revolutionary movement. And they're flummoxed after receiving word from fellow disciples that Jesus' body was no longer in the tomb. The disciples are angry and they're anxious. They're afraid and they're flummoxed. Hence, they're walking to Emmaus, a place that might symbolically signify a city of escape in this story. The great theologian Fred Buechner says that Emmaus is a place that one might go to just throw up one's hands and say, it makes no difference to me anyway, anymore. I tell you, when I look at the beautiful students and members of this community that I teach and engage on this campus, I can detect the explosive sentiments of anger, anxiety, fear, and confusion that converge into Molotov cocktails of emotions. Many in our community are understandably angry over injustice, economic inequality, racial exclusion, and environmental degradation are all critical issues that we must address both on this campus and in the larger society. Yet we're equally anxious. We're anxious about our own culpability as direct and indirect beneficiaries of such unjust realities. Might it be, my friends, that at times our vehement protests are just a method to assuage our own guilt rather than an actual concern about the people and the issues we profess to care about? Likewise, many of us are afraid about the future. Will we leave subsequent generations, our children, a world where they will feel safe and secure? Many of us, however, are confused about where to begin and how to act when problems seem so systemic and obstacles seem so insurmountable. This is not even to mention the inevitable temptation that will arise from egoism. For it seems that history has proven that the older one gets, the allure of self-protection and securing one's own self-interest becomes more and more an attractive and viable option. Thus, it's tempting at one point or another just simply throw up our hands and walk to a place called Emmaus. Oh, my dear, the Reverend John Buchanan gave me a collection of essays this week by the late historian and essayist Tony Jude that lays this dilemma out well, particularly in relation to the beautiful and bright students across this country. Tony Jude declares in this work, he says, dissent and dissidents are overwhelmingly the work of the young. Whether Jesus and his disciples in Jerusalem, the men and women of the French Revolution, or civil rights activists in the 20th century, reformers are generally younger than those who are resolved to the status quo. But unfortunately, young people are also more likely to be tempted toward apoliticism. They view politics and political engagement as so degraded and overdetermined toward injustice that they simply throw up their hands and give up on it. They turn inward. And just like the disciples in today's text, young people are tempted to walk away from the struggle toward Emmaus, a city of escape. Emmaus. The city can take many different forms for many of us. For some, it may be alcoholism. For others, hypermaterialism. For some of us, it's narcissism. And for others, it's hyper-religiosity and ecclesiastical rigidity. But what such responses share in common are an urge to take flight. An urge to escape grim realities by embracing the assumed safety of an illusory reality. Some of you may remember the story of a 30-something former hedge fund trader by the name of Sam Polk. Mr. Polk started quite the firestorm earlier this year when he published a piece in the New York Times on what he considered wealth addiction. While an undergraduate at Columbia, Mr. Polk was a regular user of cocaine, marijuana, and ecstasy. And it was a counselor who helped him to see that narcotics became a means to blunt the powerlessness he felt as a kid. The anger, the anxiety, the fear, the confusion from conditions of an unstable childhood. His path from an insecure childhood of struggle toward an Emmaus of seeming safety was drug abuse. Fortunately, Mr. Polk was able to walk away from drug abuse, yet he found himself captured by the allure of Wall Street. He worked his way up from a $40,000 a year bonus at the age of 22 to $3.6 million bonus by the age of 30. He admits to having made more money in a year than his mother, a nurse practitioner, made in her entire life. Yet he still wanted more. Mr. Polk wanted more from life. And like narcotics, money just became another source of escape to help him blunt what he now calls a spiritual malady. A malady that only began to heal once he went back and began serving young people who are now in similar circumstances that he was once in as a child. Unlike the North Carolina woman who declared she needed a savior who can meet her needs, not someone who is needy, Mr. Polk found his deliverance in those whom he could help along life's narrow way. And this is what we witness, my friends, in this morning's text. Disciples who are trying to get away in search of something. Their heads are hung down low. Their spirits are low. But Jesus shows up to change their outlook. Here you have disciples walking along, talking about death and the crucifixion. And this man, a presumed stranger, shows up and begins talking about life and the resurrection. These men are expressing anxiety and insecurity, but Jesus directs their attention toward God's power and God's glory. And they're nervous about their future, so Jesus reminds them about a God that's always been faithful in the past. Oh, I can hear them along this road walking and talking with Jesus, and Jesus reminding them of all the ways that God has come through for God's people. Oh, God was Jehovah Jireh, the one who provided for Abraham. He was Jehovah Rapha, the one who heals for Moses. Jehovah Nissi, the one who fought battles alongside of you, like he'll fight battles alongside of Joshua. God was Jehovah Shalom, the one who will bring us peace in the midst of our storms. And the same way Jesus was telling them that God stood on the side of justice and right in the past, we have to believe that this God is still Jehovah Shammah, the one who is present with us right now. This presumed stranger proved to be a good companion, proved to be good company. They did not know who he was, but they came to realize that they were keeping good company on this path. This is the reason they begged him to stay. And in the same vein, as believers, we too must surround ourselves with this kind of company. It's tempting for us to pick friends according to cool factors or prominence, and those who will make us feel good or look good or feel important. Yet we learn from this text that we should never judge good company by initial impressions. For this man appeared as a stranger along the road and began the conversation in a way that could be interpreted as an insult. But leave it to Jesus to demonstrate the attributes of a real friend. Someone who will do more than show up to celebrate successes, but walk with you when you're confused and sad. A friend is someone who will encourage you positively and challenge you constructively. And a friend is someone whom you can do more than play with. It's someone whom you can also be candid and pray with. Good company. Good company will not allow us seminarians to disengage on the road to Emmaus so that we can throw up our hands and throw in the towel of life. Good company will affirm our anxiety, but then keeps us from looking for an escape. Good company. Good company will attend to our anger, but then call us to positive and constructive action. Good company will acknowledge the validity of our fears, but then challenge us to be led by our faith. Jesus shows up to tell these disciples and to tell us this morning that our work is not done. It's not over. Evil and injustice will not have the last word as long as we believe in the power of love and believe in a Christ that will still remain in our midst and be our hope for tomorrow. Well, I have to say, as I prepare to take my seat, this whole narrative reminds me of a legend surrounding famed 19th century American chess player Paul Morphy. This story was first reported in 1888 in the Columbia Chess Chronicle. Mr. Morphy was in Richmond, Virginia, visiting with a friend, the Reverend Robert Reed Howison. And there, Mr. Morphy noticed a picture on his host's wall. It was a Friedrich Retzsch's 1831 painting entitled The Chess Players. The painting artistically captures the human condition. False devil Mephistopheles has a confident and cruel smirk on his face across the chessboard from a seemingly defeated young man who is playing for his soul. The gloating grin of the devil is only matched by the dejected and defeated demeanor of his opponent. Reverend Howison's company, the chess master Morphy, inspects the painting, and then he declares before dinner, "This game is not over. The young man in that painting has a few more moves." And after recreating the chessboard in the parlor, and to the amazement of all, Paul Morphy made a move that defended this young man's position and subsequently retrieved the game. And this is what I'm here to tell somebody this morning. Whatever you may be going through, whatever obstacles seem insurmountable, whatever trials seem too much to handle, there's no need for you to blow balloons for your pity party or pack luggage for your guilt trip on the way to Emmaus. For checkmate in the game of life has not been called. This is why, when you and I avail ourselves to strangers and keep the right kind of company, we never know when the grace, love, and transformative power of Christ will show up in our lives. And Christ will say to us, "This game is not over. There's still a few more moves to be made." This is why we have to keep good company. Let the church say amen.